Chapter 1. In February 2052, in the remote Long Earth, on another world, under a different sky, in another universe whose distance from the datum, the Earth of mankind, was nevertheless counted in the mundanity of human steps, Joshua Valiente lay beside his own fire. Hunting creatures grunted and snuffled down in the valley bottom. The night was purple velvet, alive with insects, and spiky with invisible jiggers and no-see-ums that made kamikaze dives on every exposed inch of Joshua's flesh. Joshua had been in this place 2 weeks already, and he didn't recognize a damn one of the beasts he shared this world with. In fact, he wasn't too sure where he was, either geographically or stepwise. He hadn't troubled to count the Earths he'd passed through. When you were on a solitary sabbatical, precise locations kind of weren't the point. Even after more than 3 decades of travelling the Long Earth, he evidently hadn't exhausted its wonders. Which was making him think. Joshua was going to be 50 years old this year. Anniversaries like that made a man reflective. Why did it all have to be so strange? He spoke aloud. He was alone on the planet. Why the hell not speak aloud? All these parallel worlds and stuff. What's it all for? And why did it all have to happen to me? And why was he getting another headache? As it happened, the answers to some of those questions were out there, both in the strange sideways geography of the Long Earth and buried deep in Joshua's own past. In particular, a partial answer about the true nature of the Long Earth had already begun to be uncovered as far back as July of the year 2036, out in the High Megas. As long as they lived in the house in New Springfield, and it was only a few years in the end, Cassie Poulsen would always try her best to forget what she'd found when she dug the cellar out back in the summer of 36. Cassie hadn't been too sure about her new world when she'd first arrived, just a year before that. Not that she was unsure of her own ability to make a home or raise a family out here in the barely explored wilds of the Long Earth, or of the relationship she had with Jeb, which was as strong and true as the iron nails he was already turning out of his forge. Nor did she doubt the folks who had walked with them all this way, an epic trek of more than 1 million steps from the datum, in search of a new home in one of the myriad worlds revealed just a few years back by Joshua Valiente's pioneering exploration in the very first of the Long Earth airships. No, it was the world itself that she'd had trouble with, at first, anyhow. Earth West 1,217,756 was forest. Nothing but forest. It was all totally alien for a girl who'd done most of her growing up in Miami West 4, which back in those days had been little more than a minor suburb of its parent city on the datum. But it had got better as their first year wore away. Cassie had learned to her delight that there were no real seasons here, none of the summers that turned Miami West 4 into a ferocious oven, and no winters to speak of either. You could just kind of relax about the weather. It would never bother you. And meanwhile, aside from the usual suite of mosquitoes and other nibbling insects, there was nothing in this forest that would harm you. Nothing worse than a finger nip from a frightened furball. Nothing, as long as you stayed away from the rivers where the crocodiles lurked, and the nests of the big birds. And it got better yet, when she and Jeb had cleared enough ground to start planting their first crops, of wheat and potatoes and lettuce and beets, and the chickens and goats and pigs started having their young, and she and Jeb had hammered together the beginnings of their own home. Yes, it was all going fine, until the day Jeb decreed they needed a cellar. Everybody knew that a cellar was a sensible precaution, both as a store and as a refuge from such hazards as twisters and bandits with stepper boxes. While Jeb and the neighbours didn't expect any trouble, well, you never knew, and it would be a comfort to have it in place before they started a family. So here was Cassie, digging in the earth with the bronze spade she'd carried with her all the way from Miami West 4, while Jeb was off with a party, trying once more to hunt down a big bird. The work wasn't hard. The ground had already been stripped of tree cover and the roots dug out, and Cassie was strong, toughened up by trekking and pioneering. By early afternoon, Cassie, filthy and sweating, was digging into a hole that was already deeper than her head height, which was when her spade suddenly pushed into open air, and she fell forward. She caught herself, stepped back, took a breath, and looked closer. She'd broken through the wall of the nascent cellar. Beyond was a deep black, like a cave. She knew of no animal that would dig a burrow as big and deep as this looked to be. There were ground-dwelling furballs here, but nobody had seen one much bigger than a cat. Still, just because nobody had seen such a critter didn't mean it couldn't exist. And there was a good chance it wouldn't enjoy being disturbed. She ought to get out of there. But the day was calm. A couple of her neighbours were chatting over lemonade just a few yards away. She felt safe, and curiosity burned. This was something new in the endless, unchanging summer of New Springfield. She bent down to peer into the hole in the wall, only to find a face looking back out at her. It was human-sized, but not human. More insectile, she thought, a kind of sculpture of shining black, with a multiple eye, like a cluster of grapes, and half of it was coated with a silvery metal, a mask. She saw all this in the heartbeat it took for the shock to work through her system. Then she yelled and scrambled back. When she looked again, the masked face was gone. Josephine Barrow, one of her neighbours, walked over and looked down from above.
"You okay, honey? Put your spade through your foot?"
"Can you help me out?"
She raised her arms. When Cassie was up on the surface, Josephine said,
"You look like you saw a ghost."
Well, she'd seen something. Cassie looked around at her house, which was almost ready to get its permanent roof put on, and the fields they'd cleared for their crops, and the hole they'd already dug to make a sandpit for their kid to play in some day. All the work they'd put into this place, all the love. She didn't want to leave this. But she also didn't want to deal with whatever the hell was down in that hole.
"We need to cover this up," she said now.
Josephine frowned.
"After all your work?"
Cassie thought fast.
"I struck groundwater. No good for a cellar here. We'll dig a well someday."
There was a heap of rough-cut timber leaning against the back wall of the house.
"Help me."
She started to lay the planks over the hole. Josephine stared at her.
"Why not just fill it in?"
Because it would take too long. Because she wanted this hidden for good before Jeb got back.
"I'll backfill it later. For now, just help me, okay?"
Josephine was looking at her strangely. But she helped her even so, and by the time Jeb got back, Cassie had spread dirt and forest floor muck over the timber so you'd never know the hole was there, and had even scraped out the beginnings of a second cellar around the far side of the house. And by the time they sat down to eat that evening on the porch of their home, Cassie Poulsen was well on the way to forgetting she'd ever seen that masked face at all. And a few years later, in March 2040, Miami, Earth West 4. It was only a coincidence, historians of the next would later agree, that Stan Berg should be born in Miami West 4, the low Earth footprint city where Cassie Poulsen had grown up. Cassie Poulsen, on whose high megas property the primary assembler anomaly proved to be located, an anomaly which, in the end, would shape Stan Berg's short life, and much more. Strange, but only a coincidence. Of course, in the very year Stan was born, the town began to change dramatically, as the first of a flood of refugees from a datum America blighted by Yellowstone began to show up. By the time Stan was 8 years old, an increasingly crowded, lawless, and chaotic camp had been taken over by government and corporate interests and transformed into a remarkable construction site. and by Stan's 11th birthday, there was a new star in the sky, stationary above the southern horizon. Not a true star, but the orbital terminus of a nascent space elevator that reached down to the local version of Florida, built by a community of hastily recruited stork jacks that by then included Stan's own mother and father. But whatever the convulsions that would color Stan's young life, there was nothing strange about the love that filled Stan's mother, Martha, from the moment she first held her child. And she, at least, saw nothing strange in the apparent curiosity with which, eyes precociously open, Stan inspected the changing world from the moment he was delivered into it. Joshua Valiente was always skeptical about Bill Chambers' Joker stories. But, he would realize in retrospect, if he'd paid more attention and thought a little more deeply about what Bill was saying, he might have got some earlier clues into the meaning of it all. Such as what Bill told him in 2040, the same year Stan Berg was born, as he traveled with Joshua in an airship into the high megas, far beyond New Springfield. A story about a Joker he called the cue ball. Joshua had actually glimpsed this Joker himself. He and Lobsang had in fact discovered it, nestling in that band of relatively domesticated worlds called the Corn Belt, on their first journey out into the deep, long earth, during which Joshua had first learned the meaning of the word. "Jokers," Lobsang had said, "worlds that don't fit the pattern, and there is a pattern, generally speaking. But the broad patterns are broken up by these exceptions. Jokers in the pack, as scholars of the Long Earth call them." Joshua already knew many such worlds, even if he'd had no name for the category. This Joker had been a world like a pool ball, an utterly smooth, colourless ground under a cloudless deep blue sky. But even though he'd seen the place for himself, Joshua knew better than to take Bill's stories at face value. Bill Chambers, about Joshua's age, had grown up alongside him at the home in Madison, Wisconsin. He'd been a friend, a rival, a source of trouble, and always a consummate liar. Bill said now, "I know a fella who knew a fella." "Oh, yeah?" "Who camped out on the cue ball for a bet. Just for a night. All alone, as you would. In the nip, too. That was part of the bet."
"Sure."
"In the morning, he woke up with a hangover from hell. Drinking alone. Never wise. Now, this fella was a natural stepper. So he got his stuff together in a blind daze and stepped. But he says he sort of stumbled as he stepped."
"Stumbled?"
"He didn't feel as if he'd stepped the right way."
"What? How's that possible? What do you mean?"
"Well, we step east or we step west, don't we? You have the soft places, the shortcuts, if you can find them. But that's pretty much it." Stepping. On step day, the world had pivoted around mankind. Suddenly, in return for the effort of building a stepper box, a crude electrical gadget, and some, like Joshua, didn't even need that, you could step sideways out of the old reality, out of the world, and into another. Just like the original, yet choked with uncleared forest and replete with wild animals. For it was only in the original Earth that mankind had evolved, and had had a chance to shape its world. Whole planets a short walk away, and in either direction, east or west, you could take another step, and another. If there was an end to the Long Earth, as the chain of worlds became known, it was yet to be found. After step day, everything had been different, for mankind, for the Long Earth itself, and in particular, for Joshua Valiente. But even the Long Earth had its rules, or so Joshua had always thought. "Anyhow, this fella felt like he'd stepped a different way, perpendicular, like he'd stepped north."
"And?"
"And he emerged onto some kind of other world. It was night, not day. No stars in the clear sky, no stars, sort of. Instead..."
Your storytelling style really great sometimes, Bill. But I've got you hooked, haven't I? Get on with it. What did he see?
He saw all the stars. All of them. He saw the whole feckin' galaxy, man. The Milky Way. From outside.
Outside the galaxy. Thousands of light years from Earth. From any Earth. Bill said,
still in the nip he was, too.
That was the trouble with comers, Joshua had concluded. They were just expert bullshitters. Maybe they spent too much time alone. But, he realized, reflecting in February 2052, he tended to think even of Lobsang as a bullshitter, albeit a shitter built on a truly cosmic scale. If only he'd listened to Lobsang when he'd had the chance. Now it was too late, for Lobsang was dead. Joshua had been there when it had happened, in the late fall of 2045. He and Sally Lindsay had waited by the door of the home in Madison West 5. It was early evening, and the streetlights sparked. Sally was in her travelling gear, a multi-pocketed fisherman's jacket under a waterproof coverall, a light leather pack on her back. As usual, she looked like she was going to light out of here at any moment, and the longer the sisters took to answer the damn door, the more likely that became. Look, Joshua said, trying to forestall her. Just take it easy. Say hello. Everybody here wants to see you, to say thank you for what you did for the next. Busting those super smart kids out of the Pearl Harbor facility.
You know me, Joshua. These low earths are mob scenes nowadays. And places like this, this home, where they lock you up for your own good. I don't care how happy or otherwise you were here, Joshua, with those penguins.
Don't call them penguins.
As soon as we're done, I'm going to get blind drunk as fast as possible. Then you'll need something stronger than our sweet sherry.
Sister John had quietly opened the door. Now she smiled.
Come on in.
Sally shook the sister's hand with good enough grace. Joshua followed them in, walking down a corridor into what was to him an eerie recreation of the home he'd grown up in, the original long ago wrecked by the Datum Madison nuke. Sister John, her head enclosed in a crisp wimple, leaned closer to Joshua.
So, how are you?
Fine. Disoriented to be here.
I know. Doesn't quite smell right, does it? Well, give the mice a few decades to do their work, and they'll put that right.
And you? You're running the place now. To me, you'll always be plain old Sarah.
Who you had to rescue from the forest on step day. When you come back here, it feels like we suddenly got all grown up, didn't we?
Yeah. To me, the superior ought to be a towering figure. And old.
As old as me?
Sister Agnes was waiting for them in the doorway of the home's parlor, the posh lounge where the sisters had always received visitors. But Agnes, eerily, now looked younger than Sister John. And when Joshua submitted to a hug, there was just the faintest hint of artifice, an excessive smoothness in the cheek he kissed. And beneath her practical, slightly shabby habit, an alarming, almost subliminal sense of super strength. After her death, Lobsang had brought Agnes back to life, downloading her memories into a lifelike android shell, while simultaneously chanting Buddhist prayers. To Joshua, it was as if somebody had turned his life's chief mother figure into a Terminator robot. But he had known Lobsang a long time, and he'd learned to see the spirit inside the machine. As with Lobsang, so now with Agnes. He said simply,
hello, Agnes.
And Sally Lindsay.
With Sally, it was a wary handshake rather than a hug.
I've heard so much about you, Miss Lindsay. Ditto.
Agnes studied her intently, almost challengingly, before turning away.
So, Joshua, how are your family?
Such a shame you're apart from your little boy.
Joshua said, Not so little. Well, you know me. I've a split soul, Agnes. Half of me always drawn away out into the long earth.
Still, you're home now. Come and join the party.
Sitting side by side on the usual overstuffed armchairs, some of them originals, retrieved from the old Datum home, were Nelson Azikiwe and Lobsang. Lobsang, or at least this ambulant avatar, with shaven head and bare feet, was dressed in what had become his trademark garb of orange robe. Sally was briskly introduced to Nelson. South African-born, a former clergyman now in his 50s, he was dressed comparatively soberly, in a suit and tie. This ill-matched pair were balancing china teacups on their knees and plates bearing slices of cake. A younger sister, whom Joshua didn't recognize, was fussing around, serving. And Shimi, the cat, was here. She came to Joshua, favoring him with a brush against his legs, and she glared at Sally with LED green eyes. As Joshua and Sally sat down, Agnes joined the circle, and Sister John and her young companion served up more tea and cake. Agnes said, Well, this was my idea, Joshua. In this moment of comparative calm, now that the latest global panic, when we all thought we were going to be driven to extinction by super-brained children, has somewhat subsided, my plan was to bring Lobsang here and to gather his friends together for once.
Sally scowled. Friends? Is that how you think of us, Lobsang? We're gaming tokens to you, more like. Dimes to feed the slot machine of fate.
Nelson grinned. Quite so, Miss Lindsay. But here we all are, even so.
Friends, Agnes said firmly. What else is there in this life but friends and family?
Lobsang, calm, rather blank-faced, said, Your own family is making waves just now, Sally. Your father, at least, with his ideas of a new kind of space development.
Ah, yes. Dear old Papa,
dreaming of using his Martian beanstalks to open up access to space, a straight-line path to massive industrialization.
Willis Lindsay is wise in his way. We should build up again from this low base we've been reduced to by Yellowstone, as fast and as cleanly as we can, and space elevators will make that possible. After all, we may someday need to compete with the next.
Nelson asked, What do you know about the next, Lobsang? I know they made some kind of contact with you. Is there any more than you've said publicly?
Only that they've gone. All those brilliant children, emerging all over the datum, all over the long earth. The next step in human evolution. That our government rounded up and put in a pen on Hawaii. Gone to a place they call the Grange. Out in the long earth somewhere. I couldn't even speculate where.
Sally laughed.
They didn't tell you. They just left you to clear up their mess at Happy Landings, didn't they? This is twisting you up, isn't it, Lobsang? The omnipresent, omniscient god of the long earth, reduced to a messenger boy by children.
Joshua made to hush her, but Lobsang said,
No, let her speak. She's right. This has been a difficult time for me. You know that as well as anybody, Joshua. And in fact, that's the reason I allowed Agnes to call you all together.
Agnes stiffened.
Oh, you allowed it, did you? And there was me thinking this was all my idea.
Lobsang looked at them in turn. At Sally, Nelson, Joshua, Agnes, Sister John.
You are my family. That's how I think of you all. Yet you have family ties of your own. You mustn't neglect them.
He turned to Nelson.
You too are not as alone as you thought you were, my friend.
Nelson looked intrigued rather than offended at this opacity.
Textbook enigmatic. Typical Lobsang.
I don't mean to be obscure. If you just think back to when we went to New Zealand...
Evidently frustrated at this hijacking of her party, Agnes interrupted sharply.
Lobsang, if you've something to say, you'd better get to the point.
Lobsang sat forward, shoulders hunched. Suddenly he looked to Joshua, unaccountably old. Old and tired.
Yellowstone and the collapse of the datum were hard for me. I suffuse the long earth. I have iterations scattered across the solar system, but my center of gravity was always datum Earth. Now the datum itself is grievously wounded, and so, as a consequence, am I.
He pressed his thumbs into his temples.
Sometimes I feel incomplete, as if I am losing memories, and then losing the memory of the loss itself. Yellowstone to me was like a lobotomy. Since then I have had doubts. I told you of this, Joshua. I have had the odd sensation that I remembered my previous incarnations, but that is not the accepted norm under the Tibetan tradition. If my reincarnation has been fully successful, I should shed all memory of my previous lives. Perhaps this reincarnation is imperfect then, or, he glanced at Agnes, perhaps there is some more mundane explanation. I am, after all, nothing but a creature of electrical sparks in distributed stores of black corporation gel. Perhaps I have been hacked. And then came the next, and their verdict on me. Before all this, I imagined I would become, yes, Sally, omnipresent, omniscient. Why not? All of mankind's computer systems, all communications would ultimately be integrated into one entity, into me, and I would cradle all of you in safety and warmth forevermore.
Sally snorted. An evermore of subordination? No thanks. He looked at her sadly.
But what of me? Without my dream, I am nothing.
Carefully, he put down his teacup. Agnes was clearly alarmed by this small gesture.
What do you mean, Lobsang? What are you going to do?
He smiled at her.
Dear Agnes, this will not hurt, you know. It is just that I...
He froze. Just stopped, mid-motion, mid-sentence. Agnes cried,
Lobsang? Lobsang!
Joshua rushed to his side. With Agnes. As Joshua held Lobsang's shoulders, Agnes rubbed his hands, his face. Synthetic hands on synthetic cheeks, Joshua thought, and yet the emotion could not have been more real. Lobsang's head turned. Just his head, like a ventriloquist dummy. To Joshua first.
I have always been your friend, Joshua.
I know.
Now Lobsang looked up at Agnes.
Don't be afraid, Agnes,
he whispered.
It is not dying. It is not dying.
His face turned slack. For a moment there was stillness. Then Joshua became aware of a change in the background, the soft, routine sounds of the home, a ceasing of noise, of the humming of invisible machines, of fans and pumps, a closing down. Glancing out of the window, he saw lights flicker and die in the building opposite, whole blocks growing dark further out. Somewhere an alarm bell sounded. Agnes grabbed Lobsang's shoulders and shook him.
Lobsang! Lobsang! What have you done? Where have you gone? Lobsang, you bastard!
Sally laughed, stood up, and stepped away. Of course, even Lobsang had never known it all. Some of the mysteries of Joshua's own peculiar nature were hidden, it would turn out, not in the stepwise reaches of the long earth, but deep in time. Mysteries that had begun to tangle up as early as March 1848, in London, datum Earth. The applause was thunderous. and the great Elusivo could hear it as he went down the steps to the stage door of the Victoria Theatre. His ears still ringing from the din of the Threepenny Gallery, now he was battered by the sights and sounds of the new cut. The shop windows, the stalls, the jostling traffic, the street entertainers, the beggar boys tumbling for pennies. And of course there were people waiting for Luis outside. In the dark of a Lambeth evening, there always were. Even young ladies. Hopeful young ladies, perhaps. But this time, a quiet voice, a male voice, called from an alley.
You move very fast, don't you, mister? One might say remarkably fast. Shall I call you Luis? I believe that is your rightful name, or one of them. I have a proposition for you, which is that I should take you out to dinner at the Drunken Clam, Lambeth's finest oyster house, if you didn't know it already, because I do know you're very fond of your oysters.
The figure was indistinct in the shadows. You have me at a disadvantage, sir.
Yes, I do, don't I? And the reason I am speaking so rapidly to you, not to say forcefully, is that I know that at any moment you wish, you may simply vanish. It is a faculty that serves you very well, as I see. Yet you do not know how you do it, and nor do I. To cut a long story short, sir,
there was a slight breeze as the man disappeared.
And then appeared again.
He gasped and clutched his stomach, as if he'd been punched. But he stood straight and said, I can do it as well.
My name is Oswald Hackett. Luis Ramon Valiente. Shall we talk?
And in February 2052, in the remote Long Earth, overhead, Joshua Valiente's own personal star shone for his benefit alone. It was, after all, reasonable to assume that his was the only soul in the whole of this particular creation. He still had that headache. And not only that, the stump of his left arm itched. As something squealed and died in the dark, the spirit of Valiente moved on the face of the darkness, and it was sore afraid to the soles of his feet.
I'm getting too old for this, Joshua muttered aloud.
He started to pack up his stuff. He was going home.